The Dean of the Washington Cathedral, Dr. Sayre, anguished in public some Sundays ago. He wasn't happy with both of the candidates for the presidency and with the electorate, and indeed with the entire context of our national life. The Dean's plaint put me in mind of a delightful quatrain of Ogden Nash's. They are of such refined and delicate palates, they can find no one worthy of their ballots. And then when someone terrible is elected, they say, there, that's what I always expected. Frankly, we lose our right to criticize those who are nominated when we spend the better part of each 4 years preoccupied with our individual concerns. And then when the party active and the party loyal nominate lifelong public servants who somehow do not measure up to our expectation, we have no right to complain in public. Many of us seem to have forgotten that an election in the United States is not a confrontation between two individual candidates, but of parties and party nominees. And if we are not partisan, party active, all that we can do on election day is to ratify the selection of one or another small group of people who have nominated the candidates for our consideration. Frankly, I've never been overmuch impressed by these civic undertakings, get out the vote. 10 minutes before a voting machine on election day hardly discharges our civic obligations. Vote, and vote wisely, and vote deliberately. But if you wish truly to be effective in this democracy of ours, cease worrying about your independence, your pristineness. Become partisan. Become partisan of a party and help that party to nominate men and women who are worthy of consideration. Now, every election has its share of pretense and of knavery, of oratorical hyperbole, of tongue-in-the-cheek promise, the half-truth. Every election brings out also its full quota of the doom speakers, of the apocalypse, of those who believe that Inauguration Day will be the end of days if the opposition candidate is elected. I, for one, this election do not share this millenarianism. I do not believe that if Lyndon Johnson is elected President of the United States, he will, on Inauguration Day, transfer the United States Treasury to a Swiss bank under an assumed name. And I also do not believe that Barry Goldwater, if he is elected President of the United States, will on Inauguration Day press the button of an atomic war. Our choice is not between a savior and the devil. It's not between a man who wears horns and a man who wears a halo. It's not between good and evil. But it is between two adequately decent men, both of whom can point with pride to a lifetime of public service. This is not, as some would have it, democracy's last chance. Nor is it an election, as others would have it, of freedom's last chance. Rather is it, as all American elections have been, another chance for us to express our will on two slightly divergent approaches to our national destiny. I spoke of the knavery and the pretense which attends any national election. Unfortunately, there is, beyond this accepted trickery, an underworld, an ugly shadow world of gutter gossip and of scabrous literature. And this year, I am afraid, the rats have come out of the walls in increased numbers. There have been all manner of contemptible stories invented and repeated and retold. I'm told that millions upon millions of paperbacks have been printed impugning, and needless to say, incorrectly, impugning the decency and the loyalty of the two candidates for the presidency, one of whom at least will be the president of the United States. And I have seen, as you have seen, all matter of card and poster of the most contemptible form, scandalous, mischievous, miserable, impugning the decency, the loyalty of two decent men. Now, usually on election day, one does not have to make much of this literature. It tends to circulate among the perverted and the paranoid, the shadow world people. But let's be honest about it. We have seen these cards and these paperbacks in strange and near places. We have heard these stories repeated. So let's say it quite baldly and at the beginning. President Johnson is not a communist, nor is he a communist sympathizer, nor is he soft on communism. Senator Goldwater is not a fascist, nor is he a fascist sympathizer, nor is he part of any conspiracy to destroy American freedoms. Neither man is a traitor. Each is a lifetime public servant, which is far more than many of us can claim. The only traitors this election day are the men and the women who pass this gutter literature, to sap and undermine thereby the basic decency and dignity of our nation. This too, I think, ought to be said by way of preface to my comments on this election. There is in the election of 1964 no item of parochial Jewish concern. Senator Goldwater's family left Judaism a generation ago and without rancor. Democratic Party has made no mention of the senator's religion, present or ancestral, and that is as it should be. Nor has the senator attempted to trade on his religion, exchanged or inherited, and that too as it should be. Perhaps, alibi, we are coming to that point in American history when political religious affiliations have ceased to be an item to be weighed in the political balance. And I believe that as a rabbi, this too also should be said. Both men have often expressed their friendship and admiration for the State of Israel. Within a month of his coming into office, the president announced the important American-Israel water desalination project. He warmly welcomed Prime Minister Eshkol to Washington in July of this year. A welcome all the warmer because throughout the winter and the spring, the President of the United States had not listened to the threats and the challenges of General Nasser. As recently as a week ago, President Johnson reaffirmed the concern of the United States with stability in the Middle East, with the integrity of present boundaries in the Middle East, and he reminded all nations in that part of the world that the United States would not countenance aggression or the threat of force or the use of force against any other nation. Senator Goldwater has not spoken as often or in such detail about Israel. But whenever he has spoken warmly. He knows General Nasser for the kind of person that he is. And he too has spoken of the need to maintain Middle East stability and to prevent an imbalance in the arms race. There are no private concerns of the American Jewish community in this campaign. Let's turn to the campaign itself. Senator Goldwater rode a long and arduous primary in order to give the American people, so he said, a choice, and not an echo. Many looked forward to an exciting political clash, a debate of ideologies and of political philosophies, an across-the-board assessment of basic American policy. And I confess that this debate seems not to have been joined. Indeed, in my humble opinion, this has been one of the dullest campaigns on record. The oratory has been out of focus, vague. The issues have become blurred. I, for one, miss the excitement of the television debates of 4 years ago. I can fully understand President Johnson's concern for the dignity of his office, and I agree with him that he ought not to jeopardize that dignity in this kind of televised face-to-face debate. But there at least the men stood face-to-face and grappled with the same issues. All along these past weeks, I have had the feeling that they are operating on different levels of discourse. Many words, much emotion, but the issues seem not to have been joined. And I regret this. It is good for a democracy. It is necessary and vital for the health of a democracy to have a real investigation of its basic principles every few years. And it is good and it is vital for an administration, whoever is elected, to come into office with some kind of public mandate as to its expressed philosophy. We have not had this meeting of issues, this searching investigation of our basic principles this election, however much this has been trumpeted. I would agree with General Eisenhower, who told a trailing group of reporters some 10 days ago, I just cannot describe the issues. I just can't find the issues in this campaign. And there are issues, serious, impending, immediate issues for the American people. There is the issue of Vietnam. We have made a military commitment in Vietnam which seems incapable of bringing results. Vietnam is today a tinderbox which can explode in a matter of hours into a worldwide conflagration. Whatever its success in other fields, this administration has no success with its Vietnam policy. It has been singularly unimaginative in presenting other than military choices and alternatives. It is a difficult question. How do you protect the people who do not want to be protected? How do you talk to people of their freedom if they feel themselves to be unfree and know themselves to be miserable? As disaster has piled upon disaster, we have sent more arms, more aid, more men, another expert team of military people. Then, as disaster mounted to prevent the final and ultimate outcome, we have resorted to brinkmanship in the Gulf of Tonkin. Surely there are political, diplomatic alternatives to our present military policy. What of the neutralization of the area under the United Nations or some multinational presence? These have not been presented to the American people as alternatives, as choices. All that we have so far been given is the devil and the deep blue sea. A land war against half of Asia and 800 million Chinese, or an American Dien Bien Phu. A total American military surrender. Here was the place, surely, for a choice. Instead, we have gotten neither a choice nor an echo, but more of the same. President Johnson has sent General Taylor. Senator Goldwater will send General Eisenhower. President Johnson has doubled our military commitment. The senator will double it again. President Johnson has practiced brinkmanship in the Gulf of Tonkin. The senator talks of flying over north into China and even China itself, brinkmanship over half the world. Is this a choice? I, for one, fail to see it. And there has been synthetic debate in this issue on other points, too. Much has been made of our relationship, our military relationship with our NATO allies, the so-called bulwark of freedom in Western Europe. Senator Goldwater has been determined that we shall strengthen the NATO arm. But how do you press home this choice against an administration which seems prepared to go into a bilateral nuclear agreement with West Germany if the West of Europe will not go along? Is this a choice? Are not the alternatives involved in the possibility of not granting nuclear arms to Germany? No one has asked what will be the inevitable Russian riposte to this multinational or binational nuclear force. And what is the future of Europe itself? Of a Europe that twice in the lifetime of many here was plunged into a Holocaust because of the might of the Wehrmacht. I fail to see again how the senator is giving us a choice, an alternative in our policy. Then there too, there is the, to me, synthetic debate on the issue of armaments, of our military presence. How do you press home a campaign issue as to our military strength against an administration which has increased our military budget by some 20%. Now, there is, it is true, some irony and a bit of poetic justice that this administration, which, as you remember, came into power 4 years ago on the cry of a missile gap, of military unpreparedness that should be fed some of its own medicine. But is the degree of our preparedness really the issue? Why do we need the power to destroy the world 1,000 times over when we already have the power to destroy it 100 times? How many times can a man die? What about trade, conference, treaty, a detente, an international agreement, the United Nations? How do these political and diplomatic elements enter into the foreign political picture? Here is the area of choice. For ultimately, the choice is not between deterrence and armament on the one hand, but between deterrence and armament, disarmament, peace. Again, I am afraid the senator has not made good his promise to give us a choice. It gives us only a larger stockpile of unnecessary military equipment. Senator, the President of the United States stands on the record of an administration which can point with pride to the securing of the test ban on atomic military testing. This was a significant treaty, and its ratification by the American Senate was equally significant. It made possible the beginning of a thaw in the Cold War. Much has come from it. We expect much still. The President stands as the head of an administration which has shown in act its willingness to meet all countries, all peoples, who make any overture towards agreement, towards trade and treaty and conference, to meet and to meet with an open mind. But I regret that the President has not used this campaign to spell out to the American people constructive, if complex, programs of his foreign policy. Americans have been fed for 20 years now the simple language of the Cold War, ours and theirs, the line drawing. Here is the line, thou shalt not pass. This is ours. This jumps to our tune. The American people, as we have seen in this campaign and the campaigns of the last 4 and 8 years, tend to think in terms of the enemy and friends, ours and theirs, purely in military terms. The road to peace is not the glory road, but it is the only road that we can go. And I long for the President of the United States, who stands on a record which is commendable in every respect, to make clear to the American people, not only in vague words, but in concrete suggestion and example, the road that we might take. But if we can wish that the President were more specific as to the road to peace, Senator, Marizona seems not to know that the road exists at all. I believe Senator Goldwater when he says that he is a peace-loving man, that he is not a warmonger. He is not. And yet his entire realm of thought, certainly his entire range of discourse, is military. He speaks of the enemy, of containment, of brinksmanship, of strength, of force. He is yet to speak of policy, of agreement, of treaty, of the meeting of minds. Arms can deter, he is right, strength has deterred. For how long? And what supplements it? What gives the, what establishes the foundations of a secure peace ultimately? This military myopia, I consider personally to be a major failing in a candidate for the presidency of the United States in this year of 1964. Senator Goldwater has, on the domestic scene, mounted an across-the-board attack on administration policies in the areas of economics, of welfare, and of civil rights. He speaks of from a philosophic matrix which is conservative, by his definition, which means that he prefers or tends to prefer, to prefer the individual to the social, freedom to discipline, competition to planning, charity to welfare. And he has been an effective and sometimes acid and sharp critic of existing administration programs and proposed legislation. And the senator has been able during this campaign to touch within most Americans an anxiety, a concern for some of the realities of our American life. We all deplore the growing bitterness of our cities. We all deplore the growing violence in our streets. We built our parks not for the lawless band, but for the leisure of our families. We all deplore the rising tide of hate between race and race. And the senator has been able to express the basic concern for an America caught in midstream, caught in the middle of a fundamental change from the farm to the city, from the machine to automation, from the frontier to the mass man. But again, I fail to see the constructive alternatives which he places before the American people. The president has spoken through his legislation of housing legislation, increased social security, Medicare, increased concern for the welfare of all of our citizens, a poverty bill, mass transportation bill, and the like. Now, each of this legislation can be put under searching investigation and examination, and should be. Much of it can be criticized and ought to be. But beyond the no saying, what are the constructive alternatives? The President of the United States cannot be the grand almighty critic. He must be the guide, the initiator, the leader to a better tomorrow. Senator Goldwater has not been able successfully to exchange his role in senatorial critic, presidential candidate. I must express, too, in this review of the 1964 campaign, my concern for the last weeks of this campaign. These are traditionally the weeks in which tempers become frayed, voices become more shrill. And there is already an ugly undertone of racism, hate, extremism, bigotry, the old American first, the nativist, heard in our land. Senator Goldwater is not a racist. He can point with pride to the desegregation of the Arizona National Guard and of facilities at the Phoenix Airport. He can justify his negative vote on the Civil Rights Bill on proper and narrow constitutional grounds. Yet it is true, is it not, that he has based his campaign largely on a core of voters from the white Southland and the white backlash. And though I am firmly convinced that he will disappoint, if elected, the high expectations of the white supremacist, he's a decent man. He will be bound by an oath of office to the Constitution, and he has pledged publicly that he will support the law of the land, including the Civil Rights Bill. Nevertheless, I pray that in these last weeks, he will discipline his own decency and not speak the unfortunate word which will give an aura of respectability to all the fury of prejudice in the other America. Senator Goldwater is not a racist and he is not an extremist. He is not one who intends to subvert the American democratic process, and I believe him firmly when, after the San Francisco convention, he denounced the Ku Klux Klan and the leaders of the John Birch Society. I believe that he meant it. He's been in Washington too long to believe that there is a mass conspiracy at work in the land to turn our government over to Russia. And yet again, he has based the strategy of his campaign on an appeal to the homeborn and the heartland people, to those who feel their America besieged and beleaguered. And again, there is danger that in these last weeks of the campaign, he will allow the mood of an audience to pick him up, to put words in his mouth which ought not to be spoken. He has said them already. Tuesday last in Philadelphia, he is reported to have said, "Minorities run the nation. The American people are tired of it." Who are the minorities? Who are the American people? These last weeks of the campaign, the good senator will have to walk a tightrope of his own respectability. We must all pray that he will lose his balance. He is a better man, a far better man than his own cold, calculating campaign strategy. Yet, he must keep, for all of us, for the future of the American political system, he must keep a tight rein on his own basic decency. And the polls tell us that the predominance of Jewish citizens will vote for President Johnson. If the polls are correct, if it is true, as I believe it firmly to be, that there are no unique and parochial Jewish interests in this campaign, then our vote can be explained on only one basis: that the Jewish ethos, our traditional way of looking at things, is somehow more akin to the policies of this present administration than to the policies which are being suggested to us by the challenger. And I would agree to that assessment. The Bible says nothing about states' rights. Human rights are a divine fiat. Moses never balanced a budget. He did lead a people into freedom. It is not a commandment of the Torah that we should live in a society which is organized according to laissez-faire. It is a commandment of the Torah that we live in a society which is organized to promote decency and human welfare. And yet I must add this, that I do not share the the excessive fear of some that November 3rd is Armageddon, the last stand, the last hope of a democracy to look at itself honestly and with decency. The presidency is a humbling job. It's a maturing undertaking. Men have come into the presidency with wild and vague backgrounds, and they have grown into responsible leaders of the nation. I am not one who believes that on November 4th, whatever happens on November 3rd, we will have to rise and say Kaddish for our beloved nation. But I do believe that whatever happens on November 3rd, our grand and beloved nation will have full need of our citizenship, of our concern, of our intelligence, of our minds, and of our hearts. And far too many of us have drifted away from the political arena over this past decade or so. We have been busy getting, acquiring, enjoying, and we have forgotten that democracy, any nation, is only as strong as its citizens are willing to give of themselves for the common weal. So my prayer this election year is a very simple one. It's a prayer for the health, the maturity, the wisdom, and the understanding of the two men who are candidates for the highest office in our land. It is a prayer that the man who will be elected as president will use his power with moderation and his office with understanding. That he will keep always before him the basic mandate that this must be a nation established in decency, in justice, and in freedom, and that our might is only the means to the end of peace. And I would pray finally that the next 4 years would be years of a quickened and reawakened civic interest, so that we will not shed bitter tears after nominating conventions 4 years hence. So we will not beat our breasts as to the quality of a campaign being waged, so that we will have a campaign where the big issues, the vital issues, the imperative overriding issues will be met and will be discussed. Where a grand, strong, powerful nation such as ours can make up its mind intelligently and wisely as to the proper way to our national destiny. That is my prayer.